This is Bob Lang, oral historian with the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Today is August 15th, 2013. This is the first part of the oral history interview with Emeritus Professor John Skinner of the Department of Poultry Science. So, John, to begin the interview, if for the record you would give us your birth date and birthplace and talk a little bit about who your parents were and what they were like.
Okay. My birth date is April 17th, 1924. I am the only child of John and Emma Skinner. I was born on a farm in my first night in the hospital was when I was 77 years old.
And where was this farm?
About 1¾ miles northwest of Herman, Nebraska.
Okay.
It was a small farm, and so my dad did custom sheep shearing.
Oh.
And he was a county supervisor of Burt County, Nebraska, for 32 years, and my mother never voted for him.
That's right. You told me they belonged to different parties, right?
Yeah, and they never argued about it. They informed me early on that your voting record was a secret, and you didn't argue with people on it.
And as I recall, your father was the Democrat and your mother the Republican.
That was true.
Okay. How did your parents end up in Nebraska? Do you know?
They were born. Both were born in Nebraska. My mother was German, and she was the last child of Hermann Henry Hoovendick from Germany. And my dad was the first child of John and Minnie Skinner, and he was oldest of nine, and she was the youngest of nine.
Well, that's sort of a good omen of some sort, isn't it?
Well, I would think so. I never suffered anything from being an only child. I turned to animals for my companion early on.
So there weren't other little kids in the neighborhood?
Not close by. They had a cousin living on an adjacent farm, and it was an interesting experience to follow his career and mine, because we both wound up working for the government, and I last saw him in 1958 by accident in the lobby of the Muleback Hotel in Kansas City, Missouri. And I haven't seen him since then, but I talk to him on the telephone about every 3 weeks.
Oh, do you? Oh, great.
He's in retirement in Missouri, and we have a good time going back over the youth that we spent together and how we drifted apart and how similar his career was in mine.
Uh-huh. John, did you like growing up on a farm?
Yes.
What did you like about it?
I liked to... I was always interested in animals, and I had a little bit of experience with every thing that you could put in a crate. My dad... He had all purebred livestock, and he couldn't have enough crop land acres to sell any grain. He had to buy grain and hay because he had Clydesdale horses, Ayrshire cattle, Berkshire hogs, Cheviot sheep, and Buff Orpington chickens, all British breeds.
Oh.
He was... Scotch by ancestry and grew up actually in Wales.
Oh, your father did?
Yeah.
He grew up in Wales.
Mm-hmm.
And then emigrated to the United States.
That's right.
As a young man or as a boy?
Yes, he was about 7, I think, years old.
Oh, I see. And so his family then just came to Nebraska and settled there.
Yeah.
So all of his animals were purebred English breeds.
That's right.
And
he sold males to improve the heritage of their flocks.
Uh-huh.
You get more out of the animals by keeping good ones and having a sale of sires, prospective sires, instead of going to the slaughter market.
Now, what kinds of jobs did you have to do on the farm as a boy?
Well, I was interested in chickens from the day one.
Really?
My dad gave me a pair of Buff Cochin Bantam chickens when I was 5 years old. And that started me on a career that I continued into the 20th century.
And so you just liked chickens, found them interesting?
I found any breed of livestock or any kind of livestock interesting if you knew the background of them and knew how to bring out a response in them.
Hmm. Now, did you have a flock of chickens to look after or just those two?
No, it started with those two, and when the time that I graduated from high school, I had 40 varieties of poultry, rare and fancy poultry. And I had a name stamp with that on it, and I wrote letters to other people interested in chickens, and my dad was interested in chickens too, but not in competitive way with me. But I had to grow up to be old enough to join 4-H Club, because 4-H was 7 years and up in Nebraska in the 20s and 30s.
I see. Now, so your father was focused mainly on beef cattle, was he?
No, he really liked Clydesdale horses.
Uh-huh.
And Ayrshire cattle. And he loved to study the place on earth that they originated. And I was fortunate when I retired, and even started before that, of traveling abroad and following his notes. And he went back to Belgium and Wales. I'm sorry. And he kept a detailed diary in 1896.
Oh.
And my wife and I followed his footsteps. In 73.
Oh, so you took that journal and went to the same spots?
And tried to talk to people that he had talked to.
Were there any still alive?
There were two that we located that were still alive. And one could remember when my dad came to their house.
Wow. How interesting. That must have been a very satisfying trip for you.
It really was, because my granddad had kept this detailed diary, and he identified things other than chickens. He got me familiarized with the family, and I could go back multiple times and visit them. And they come to visit us in here in America. Incidentally, that picture up there on the wall is a pen and ink drawing by Richardson. Richardson was a famous horse artist. And then the chicken was hatched from eggs that the birds that my granddad brought back on steerage on a trip to Wales.
Really? What kind of chicken is that?
That's a Cornish Indian game. In England, they're called Cornish Indian games. They're just Cornish here in the United States.
Now, your farm, your family, your parents' farm, did you raise chicken to sell?
Yeah, I traded with other people and showed them. My dad showed sheep, Chevy sheep, at county fairs and state fairs in the Midwest, and I was privileged to have the opportunity to show my chickens and put them on his truck with the sheep. And the story they tell is that when I was 7 years old, that my goal in life was to become a poultry judge.
Really?
And I achieved that in 1952. Was the youngest general licensed judge of the American Poultry Association.
Congratulations.
I never thought of anything else. And when I was drafted into service in 1942, I took advantage of the GI Bill in 46 when I come out service, and I got a bachelor's degree at the University of Nebraska in poultry science. And I did that in 33 months graduated with distinction, then went to Texas A&M for a master's degree, which I succeeded in achieving in 13 months.
Wow.
And I started on my PhD when I was still eligible for 7 months of schooling.
And did you do your PhD at Texas A&M?
I didn't complete my PhD. I came back to I should say that when I graduated from master's degree, I went to work for a hatchery in Nebraska that was setting up a breeding farm, and I was trained in genetics, and so I built and managed the farm, and it was owned by the son of a friend of my dad, the chicken connection, and he was a great man, but he was a victim of the changing industry, and I could see it coming, and we separated in good terms, and I went back to Texas A&M and joined the position of farm manager for their research farm, and I was studying on the side for the PhD.
John, I want to, before we pursue this line, I want to go back to when you lived in Nebraska and going to school.
Okay.
Were you a pretty good student in school?
I graduated with distinction.
From my high school?
Bachelor's degree. In high school, I was kind of a renegade. In a way, because schooling was terribly easy for me. And I had relatives in class, and then some of the girl relatives would have been heartbroken if I would have beat them out of quite valedictorian and not.
So you step back and let one of them become valedictorian?
She was the daughter of a cousin of my dad's. But I, in my high school class, was only 15.
So I suppose you went to a one-room schoolhouse?
No, I didn't. The day or the year that they transferred from the Burt County Davis School District to Herman for the fact that there was only 6 students in the school district, and they couldn't afford to keep a school up for that, so they hired a man with a Model T Ford van. It was had been a red truck in Omaha, Nebraska, and it was servicing grocery stores with baker's bread from the Omar Bakery. And situation was well. I always wanted to be a chicken man, and it was funny, really, when you think about it, because I had an opportunity to be among people that appreciated purebred livestock. And so I was oriented toward that. And when I was about the 10th grade of high school, my principal called me in the hallway one day, and he said, "Have you decided what you want to be when you grow up?" And I said, "Yeah, I want to pursue my interests in farming, but I'm not sure just how I'm going to do it." But he said, "Well, you better quit fooling with those darn chickens and do something you can make a living at." And when I was installed into the American Poultry Hall of Fame, I sent him a copy. He was still alive, and I sent him a copy of the program.
Did you ever hear back from him?
Yeah. He said, "I stand corrected."
When you were in high school, or even elementary school, were you particularly interested in science, or did you like all subjects?
I liked all subjects, but preferably living things. I was fortunate in having 3 parents, my dad and mother, and my mother's youngest brother was a carpenter, and he made his home with my parents. And I actually spent about more time with him than I did with my dad.
And what was his name?
Louis Hoovendick.
And he was interested in farming and chickens also?
No, he was strictly a woodworker, and he was interested in exotic plants. And he had me underfoot a lot of times. And so we developed close relationship, and I was fortunate in that he took care of me in lots of ways. And when Dad was gone a lot and was busy on politics and all like that, which he had to do because he didn't have enough crop acres He had these beautiful farm animals, purebred, and he kept them just like they were on display all the time.
Did you and he exhibit at the Nebraska State Fair?
Yes. He was superintendent of the wool show at the Nebraska State Fair. And it's funny when you think about it that he bought the Cheviot sheep from the University of Wisconsin when they were selling that breed out.
Huh. What was the breed again?
Cheviot.
Cheviot.
From the Cheviot Hills in Scotland.
So there was an early connection to Wisconsin then for you.
Yeah, I knew Frank Kleinheitz's name. He was a shepherd in Wisconsin when Dad bought the flock of sheep from him in 1932.
Was he still around when you joined the faculty here?
No. There was a tree that he planted on the campus. In front of the Vet Science Building.
Oh, really?
But that was a connection.
Is the tree still there?
Yeah.
I'll have to go take a look at it.
I think it is, unless it's been taken down in the last 2 years since I've been here.
Were your parents supportive? Well, let's see. So you graduate from high school, I assume, and then you're drafted.
Yeah.
And what was the World War II experience for you?
I was on the Battle of Iwo Jima.
Oh, you were in the Pacific.
Yeah. I was kind of a goal-breaking service, really, if you think about it, because I was drafted and general classification test was... given to me, and I made a high score in it, and I was classified as a pigeon trainer.
Oh.
And they still had homing pigeons in World War II when I went in. And they had a ruling in St. Petersburg, Florida, where I was sent for basic training, that they wouldn't make individual shipments to... when you got through with basic training, you had to be grouped. And so they pulled me out, and I took basic training twice. And they didn't find another pigeon trainer. And I was starting in the third time upon basic training. And an officer called me aside, and he said, I'm going to get you out of here. You don't have to be a pigeon trainer.
Oh.
And I said, well, I would like to be. Well, we'll get you something. So they put me in wireline school. They were getting radio and telegraph into the service. And was sent to Fort Monmouth, New Jersey, and it was ironic that I was right across the street from the pigeoner, but I couldn't be transferred to it. And so it made me mad. And I, in wireline school, I deliberately flunked at speed stuff. And they said, we know you can do it, but you got a high score in your classification test. And so we're going to break you up playing games with us. And you're going to climb telephone poles. And you know that's not very safe when you're in the motor zone and you're hanging on a telephone pole. And I said that's true. I sort of gotten the wrong attitude, but I have to take my course. And I saw an ad in the Trenton, New Jersey newspaper one Sunday when I was in Fort Monmouth and in the wire line school, and it said the Air Force was looking for people that had a high score and were not permanently assigned. And I went, got a pass and went to Trenton, New Jersey, and signed up for the Air Corps.
So you could leave the Army and go to another branch of service?
Well, you see, at that time, the Army was, the Air Corps was a division of the Army. The very first thing they did was send me to North Carolina to go to basic training.
Four times, huh?
I started in basic training four times and completed it in three. And then I was classified as an aviation cadet and sent to college in Jackson, Tennessee. And that's where I did my first flying. And I was taken to San Antonio, Texas next, to primary flight school. And I was washed out of that for an unstable stomach. I could lie in the plane and take off and fly it, it's very satisfactorily. But I'd lose my stomach when the instructor took over.
Really?
Huh. He said, "I can't give you a clean bill of health because you get sick every time I take the control." And I said, "Well, then I'm a victim of myself." And I was then sent to a replacement depot in Amarillo, Texas. And from there I went to Fresno, California in service. And didn't take any training, but I was very lucky because I was picked out of the group of 71 ex-cadets that was designed to be equivalent to a desk sergeant in the military.
Oh.
And I knew two officers that were very good to me, and they looked at my records and they said, "Well, you can do anything you want to, it sounds like." And I said, "Yeah, I don't know whether I can, but I'd try." And so I was put into the 347th Air Service Group, and the thought was that they were going to make up a small component for a little airfield on the east coast of China and be attacking the Japanese homeland from the backside. But then when the atomic bomb was dropped, the Japanese could see that their fate was doomed, and the Americans had decided that they were going to take Iwo Jima and use it for a refueling stop on the return. They wouldn't have to take a full load of fuel to get back to Saipan and Tinian. And so I was on Iwo until they dissolved it and combined all the units to start moving the troops home.
Now, were you part of the assault on Iwo Jima?
I was about on the third day on Iwo Jima, so it was still pretty hot territory. But Suribachi was in our hands by the time I got on there. And I was coming off of a ship and wading through the sand to get on the Iwo soil. And it was the middle of the afternoon, and I was looking for a place to hole up for the night, and I had field glasses, and there was a depression in the ground, and I thought that might offer some protection. And so I looked in my field glasses, and I could see an old Japanese truck that had been bombed to smithereens, and I could see that the tires were Firestone.
Oh.
And
oh, interesting.
I had more darn good luck than you could imagine, because the first night on Iwo, I was with the provost marshal, and we were checking guard posts, and what had happened, that one guard didn't call and challenged the two of us, and the lieutenant Staples was kind of a slow talking Texan, and he didn't give the password quick enough, and got shot in the middle of the forehead right beside me. And that made an impression on me then.
I'm sure it did.
And the second lieutenant was the assistant provost marshal, and he was immediately promoted. And he said, "Johnny, my boy, you're coming with me." And I was almost an orderly for a second lieutenant, but he protected me.
Well, that's good. That's good. Otherwise, you might not be here today.
That's right. I was married, should bring this up too. I got married before I went overseas. We'd been together for quite a while in sort of an unofficial way.
So you got married at 18?
I got married at 20. Jean kept me from being ever free white in 21. Because she was 6 months older than I was.
Oh, I see.
And it was interesting. The chickens figured into that, too. She was recovering from an automobile accident that killed her grandfather. And she was coming back from his funeral, and she was injured and was recovering from the accident when she stayed with one of her teachers for summer, because her mother was working and her dad was in jail. Mm-hmm. And so she was at the county fair, and dad was showing sheep and I was showing chickens. And we were, it was 1940, and we were going into the junior year of high school. And she, one of the 4-H'ers in my club, was showing her around the fairgrounds, because she was from Sioux City and we were out in Oakland, Nebraska. And Billy Hart was the kid's name, and he was taking her by the chicken display, and I had an old bantam hen with five little chicks in a pen. And Billy said to her, "Do you want to hold one of them?" And she said, "No, the owner might object." And I stepped forward and said, "I'm the owner."
And you didn't object, I take it.
No.
So, John, do you remember where you were when the war ended?
Yes, I was on Iwo Jima.
And so that would have been like August.
August of
45.
Yeah, 45.
And how long did it take you to get back to the United States?
They had a system of numbering, and you got credit for how long you had been overseas, and they sent the longest term home first. And I got home in February.
February of 46.
And that was something that was kind of bothering me too, because if you didn't have 3 years of service, you couldn't qualify for the maximum of GI Bill. And I passed my 3 years of service mark on the Pacific on headed for the United States. And I hoped the ship was dragging its feet.
So did you get your 3 months?
Pardon?
Were you in for 3 months, or for three years?
Yeah, 3 years and 10 days.
Okay, good. So you get back, you come back to your parents' home, I assume.
No, I came back to my wife's apartment.
Oh, that's right. You're married. And where was she living then?
She was living in Sioux City, Iowa.
Okay.
She was a telephone operator, and she lived with her school teacher parents. Mrs. Fratt was the registrar and librarian for Central High School in Sioux City, and he was a manual arts teacher. And they didn't have any children, and so just about called them three parents too, because her mother was working, and she had been in part Indian orphanage.
Jean had.
Yeah. And we were actually pretty young in lots of ways, but we were two lonely kids, being only children. And I tell people that we got married and grew up together.
That's a good way to do it, don't you think?
It was perfect for us. She helped put me through school because she served as a recorder and additional to my hands on my research projects.
John, do you think it was the presence of the GI Bill that let you go to college?
Yes.
If there had not been a GI Bill, do you think you would not have gone?
I don't think I could have. My folks wouldn't have been able to support me and a wife and kid in school. and I had managed to get a hold of 3 part-time jobs while I was in school. I graded papers for my major professor, and I ran air samples for the dairy science department. And I made arrangements with my landlord. He had a bunch of old houses. And because my experience with my uncle as a carpenter, I could do repair work for him on Saturdays and Sundays.
So you were busy.
Yeah. My wife worried about me because I lost weight all the time I was in school.
I bet. So, did you consider going anywhere other than the University of Nebraska?
No, I didn't, because I knew the people there. Oh. My dad was pretty well connected with the university, and that was a funny thing, too. When I was going to Texas A&M for graduate school, I met a man by the name of Bill Warwick. He was a Texan. And he came to the University of Nebraska as a shepherd. And when I was on the staff of the University of Nebraska later on, he would tell my dad, when he saw him, "I saw your daughter-in-law wearing a pair of moccasins and an Indian blanket on the campus today." And my dad was pretty much opposed to the Indian way of dealing with their stress. They would go, there was an Indian reservation on adjacent to Burt County, Nebraska, and the Indians would go about for the latter part of October, 1st of November, and then get into some mischief and broke a window or poke a tire out of a county truck and stuff like that and get put in jail, and then the county would have to feed their family. And they didn't do it in the warm weather, but they do it when the cold weather was approaching. And my dad didn't realize that Gene was part Indian until after we were married.
Oh, is that right? And then, did he and Gene get along?
Oh, yeah.
That's good. That's good.
They laughed about a lot. Bill Derrick could get my dad steamed up teasing him about having a part Indian daughter-in-law.
So, what's it like at the University of Nebraska? You go through there pretty quickly, don't you?
Yeah, I got my degree with distinction in 33 months.
So you must have had that in 1949?
No, that was 46. I went and started in Nebraska in 46.
And you would have graduated in 1949 then?
No. The 39 didn't enter into it.
49, I mean.
49, yeah. I was kind of in limbo between from junior year and senior year because I was accumulating enough points to graduate, but I was not in sync with very many others because I wanted to get through in a hurry.
And you you continued to focus on poultry science.
Yeah.
Did you look at any other areas?
No.
And poultry science at Nebraska must have been a pretty good program, was it?
It was. It didn't attract many students, but it was a good program for me because I learned several things that were new and give me confidence to go ahead with it.
And what were those new things that caught your interest?
Artificial insemination in brooder. It was just coming into its own.
Oh.
And as a result, I got pretty much notoriety from lots of game bird people and zoo people. Zoo were interested in that, and I was contacted after I got out of school Marlon Perkins with Wild Kingdom, and I became acquainted.
Really?
I had lunch with him a couple of times.
Did you?
And he was interested in using artificial insemination in zoos for endangered species.
Mm-hmm. And what else besides artificial insemination? Did you start on genetics?
Poultry breeding was my major in master's degree. Got into looking at how they were treating waste in agriculture, and I had coordinated the first seminar on using animal waste and combining it with human waste, because I had invited engineers that were used to sewage disposal plants to get on the program and talk to hatchermen and poultry dressing plant operators and big areas of egg production. Mm-hmm. And it was fortunate for me that and there were several cases in California that had judges in court determining when poultrymen should clean their chicken houses, and they didn't know anything about it, and they were inviting or encouraging the poultrymen in California to put egg layer cages in and accumulate the droppings underneath, but clean it once a week, and the manure wouldn't cure in 1 week. It all became soupy under the cages, and I couldn't get anybody to tell a judge that he didn't know what he was talking about. But I managed to get a lot of the engineers that dealt with sewage waste for him, and they looked at the fact that nobody was speaking for the chicken. And they were self-defeating to clean the birds every 7 days.
How interesting.
And that's what led me to be invited to Wisconsin. I work for 4 bosses in my professional career. I never applied for a job. I was always invited.
Well, that's pretty impressive. At what point when you're at the University of Nebraska do you realize you want to go on to graduate school?
I had in mind when I enrolled, I'm going to get all I can.
Oh, so you were recognizing yourself as a scholar, a researcher and a scholar fairly early on.
Yeah. I didn't know what I was going to wind up doing and how I was going to do it, but I knew that I had to go as fast as I could.
So are there any professors that you studied with at Nebraska who were particularly influential on you?
No, I was kind of a smart aleck. I thought I was ahead of him.
So there was nobody at the university who was a mentor for you?
No. Professor Williams was good to me, and Professor Masale was exceptionally good to me. But Masale was head of the department in Nebraska, and he gave me a desk as an undergraduate in the room where the graduate students were. And I got acquainted with the older students and would copy their notes when they were looking and stuff like that.
So,
and my wife was just as good as she could be. She took notes for me. She would make flashcards and sit across the breakfast table for me because I didn't have much chemistry in Nebraska. And I went to Texas A&M and I had to take chemistry and all wholesale.
How was it that you ended up at Texas A&M?
Lieutenant Shelby was my mentor there. He was from Texas A&M, and when we were on Iwo Jima, and then before that here in Nebraska, I was at Geneva for the Fairmont Army Air Base for overseas training. And in Iwo, I was his Gopher Boy Friday and all that.
This is the second lieutenant.
Yeah. And the thing that happened was that I'd have the Jeep in front of his tent every morning at 7 o'clock, and he'd come out, and he had the flag of Texas on display at his tent.
Oh, really?
And
we're doing fine.
And he come to my rescue every once in a while, and he actually came to visit me when I was in Texas A&M in graduate school.
So, but that's why you went to Texas A&M?
That's why I considered it. I considered Texas A&M, Ohio State, and Missouri, but Texas A&M appealed to me because he was so sure that that's the place I ought to be.
And Texas A&M.
Hello. Hello.
Good afternoon. This is Susan with the Order Processing Department.
So, John, we were talking about your decision to go to Texas A&M,
yeah.
you had looked at Ohio and Missouri as well as yeah. Texas A&M. Was the Department of Poultry Science at A&M considered a good one?
Yes, it was. It was a bigger department than either Missouri or Ohio.
Uh-huh.
Ohio had a man who I would love to study under because I knew him somewhat. And Missouri, I didn't think that was a good choice after I got their arrangements. And I could get a teaching assistantship to augment my GI Bill at Texas A&M. And that was interesting that I come to Texas A&M and they put me on probation. And I had just graduated from Nebraska with distinction. And I was kind of upset over it. And I went in to see Dean Trotter, the graduate dean. And he said, well, you Yankees now are automatically put on the probation when you come to Texas A&M because this is a better school.
Is that really what he said?
Yeah. And he said, you've proven it and that you can do it and we'll take you off probation. And I got my master's degree in 13 months and I went down to see, talk to him and confront him with it. And he said, oh, calm down, Yankee. We'll take you off.
And what was your master's thesis?
Poultry nutrition.
And what was that about? What were you studying?
Well, I was studying the feather growth of birds that were going to be used for broiler production. Parent stock, and we had high energy diets that just come into the real world, and I was measuring the hatchability of from conventional diet fed birds to the high energy diets. And there, you could get more calories in a given amount of feed if you went to high energy because you didn't have the fiber.
Oh, I see.
And the one thing that I was doing, too, with the chicken, it was... diet fed to males that were on the chicken Geiger counter with them because we had it's kind of hard to describe it, but we had radioactive feed that we were feeding to the males. And we were checking to see if their sperm had any radioactivity in it. Because if we could have come up with that, we didn't have the ability to mass scan eggs and not have to incubate them to see if they were fertile.
Was this this was new work? There wasn't anybody else doing this.
No, they were afraid to do it because that they were handling radioactive material, and a lot of people were scared of it.
Yes, you weren't apparently.
I weren't. If I could make a breakthrough, I'd try it.
So you must get your master's in about 1950?
Yeah.
And then you were telling me earlier you went to work somewhere. You didn't go on to...
I didn't go on for there. I went to work for a hatchery in Norfolk, Nebraska, and built two big two-story laying houses. And I had one thing I had done was taken my artificial insemination to treat the parent stock for broiler production. And I used Cornish birds and made them, made it into White Rock hens. And we artificially inseminated them because we could take small numbers and do a lot of sire a lot of chicks.
Okay. And this was with a family friend you were doing this?
Yeah, the guy that owned the hatchery was the son of a friend of my dad's. And they just sort of supposed that the two of us would be inseparable because of family connection and friendships. And I was gullible to start with, but I could see by the time I'd worked for him for about 4 years that it was too much for one attempt. The breeding of chickens had advanced to the point where it was called for big business like DeKalb and Highline, and you were too little to compete with them. Better join them.
I see. So you made the decision to leave the business.
Yeah. And we were... He was very accommodating to me, and he could see that I was right. And I had built him a good farm operation there that he could take and join DeKalb, which he did, and could draw their breeding program into his business. And he served as a subsidiary of DeKalb.
But you didn't want to remain in the industry, I take it.
I didn't. I'll tell you, I was selling chicks and feed and servicing flocks in addition to operating the farm, because I had help on the farm. And I could talk people into buying things that they really didn't need, and that bothered me.
Yes, I can see that. Not really how you wanted to live your life, was it?
That's right. I was always thinking, how much of that does he believe because I'm a good talker?
So you weren't, in the end, comfortable
selling? I wasn't. No, I was influencing people that I didn't think were taking it seriously enough. Their life was at stake, and their occupation, and I just didn't fit my way of thinking.
So when you left the company, you knew you wanted to go on with your education?
Yeah, he encouraged me.
Your partner did?
Yeah.
Oh, good for him. What was his name?
Sam Shireen.
So you went back to Texas A&M then?
Yeah. The department chairman there, Dr. Quisenberry, said that if I wanted to come back, he'd like to have me. And he'd give me a full staff appointment. And I could work on my PhD up to 5 hours a semester. Oh. And I went down and we didn't get it off to a good start because he promised me the house and the job for the 1st of September. And when I got there, the house wasn't ready, and he said, I think you ought to be on the staff for one semester before you start your PhD. And I said, well, that wasn't the way we sort of agreed it. And I said, I do admit that I don't have it in writing, but I think I wasn't quite aware of what was happening.
And what did happen?
What did happen? And I stayed for 3 years there, and he kept putting me off for another semester. In the meantime, I had built 4 buildings on his, and he had a big, really a big research farm in Texas A&M. I had 55 buildings and 20 full-time employees.
But no PhD.
No PhD, and I'd come to the department and to go to the class, and he'd meet me in the hallway and want to go over something, and the bell was ringing, and the professor in ag economics was looking out in the hallway and saying, come on in. And it was kind of funny because Gene said, stand up to him, don't. You got plenty of job offer. And I said, well, I don't want to have the reputation of being a jumper. And so I finally told him one day that I felt that I hadn't been treated according to my agreement and that I was going to quit. And I said, I don't have another job. I'm going to be on the market. And word got around in the poultry circles that I was available. And I had 3 job offers right quick.
From where?
Arkansas, Nebraska, and Iowa. And we, my mother was in poor health, and Nebraska was home territory, and I knew the people there. I could get along with it, and they gave me a boost in salary. I was getting $4,800 a year in Texas A&M, and they gave me $8,800 in Nebraska.
Just about double.
Darn near. So, and I just I told Gene, you get ready to go to Nebraska, and I'll take you up on Labor Day, and I'll Quisenberry with 30 days notice. I already had given him the letter, but I told him, and he spent 2 hours on the telephone trying to talk me into staying.
Really?
And I said, no, I give you fair warning that I was leaving, And I'm not blaming anybody but myself. I didn't have a clear understanding of what our relationship was. And so I got to come to Nebraska, and then I got into the market reporting, and I had the random sample turkey test, and the people in USDA Market News Service were looking at me for a job in Washington. And I wasn't interested in that because there had been a lot of travel away from home.
And do you have children by this time?
Yes. I had, my son was born when I was on Iwo Jima, so he was accompanying me through school.
Uh-huh.
And one time at Texas A&M, I was breaking out eggs that didn't hatch on one of our diets, and he was about 4 years old then, and he was taking his coloring books and toys to the lab at night, and Gene was recording for me.
Oh.
And the guys that come in, and be Dr. Quisenberry and Dr. Bryan and Dr. Mountney, and it's all they would be coming past where we were working, and they'd all speak to me, and I'd speak to them, doctor this, doctor that. And finally, since we were breaking out embryos that were dying, he looked at me, and my son looked at me, and he said, "Them little chicks shouldn't be dying with all these doctors around."
Oh, that's a sweet memory.
But I was so terribly lucky. Everything that happened to me was really better.
So now when you come to Nebraska, are you going to finish your PhD there?
No. There was no arrangement made for that.
I see. But you were teaching and doing research.
I was extension service.
I see.
On the road a lot of the time.
Just in the state, though.
Yeah, in the state.
And how long are you at Nebraska then?
6 years.
Oh. So this would be in the late 1950s?
I went to Nebraska in 57 and went to Wisconsin in 63.
So how does that happen? Why and how does Wisconsin contact you? And why do you decide to leave Nebraska and come here?
Wisconsin had one extension man retiring, and the other one was thinking about it. And the one that was thinking about retiring knew me from national meetings where they had got me as a speaker. And I was fortunate that one thing, that when I was asked to be on a program for the Institute of Poultry Industry, Institute of Poultry Industry, yeah. Dr. Quisenberry was in the audience, and he knew me, and of course, real well. And I told the man that was going to introduce me you better correct the program. You got me listed as doctor, and I don't have a PhD. And I'd appreciate it if you'd explain that to the audience, because my former boss knows that why I don't have the PhD, and he's in the audience. And he's a friend of mine, and he looked at his watch like that, and he said, "You got just 20 minutes to get the PhD."
And what does that mean exactly?
Well, it was kind of embarrassing to be performing under false pretense.
Did Quisenberry say anything about it?
No. It's funny, and over the years, he treated me as a very good friend. I thanked him for being so understanding.
That was generous of you.
Well, it don't hurt to be civil.
No, that's true.
It was... I don't know how to put it, but I was president of the American Poultry Historical Society, and the vice president was Dr. Quisenberry.
Oh. So you maintained a relationship
with him? And he worked with me, and I had him on committees and appointed him to committees and stuff when I was president.
Really? So, you're contacted by the University of Wisconsin's Extension Program?
Herb Bird was aware of what I was doing in Nebraska, and I had just completed his first public seminar on industry waste management in poultry. In agriculture. And he sent me a letter and said he'd like to come up, have me come up for interview. And so I said to Gene, we haven't experienced this yet, let's try it.
Meaning Wisconsin?
Yeah. And when I came up here, she was wild about the library and the historical society here, and she was very active in that phase of education in Nebraska. But when I got to Wisconsin, they said, "Well, now you got your." Associate professor rank in Nebraska. We can't give that to you when you come to Wisconsin. And I said, "Well, you didn't say that in your other introduction."
And was that because you didn't have a PhD?
Yeah. They didn't want to bring in a non-PhD and give him tenure to start with. That was just the rule of it. But at the time, the dean of the School of Agriculture in Wisconsin didn't have a PhD, didn't have a bachelor. He had a bachelor's degree, but not a master.
Was that Ezra Pound?
No, it was preceded Pound. He was a dairyman, and he was sort of appointed to the chairmanship in Wisconsin because of being popular with the dairy interests. So I said, "Now I enjoyed your visit and be introduced to people that I had heard about and knew." And so, but I said, "I can't give up my tenure." And I don't have the PhD, and you knew that when you invited me up here. And, well, let me, herbs, and so, but I said, I can't give up my tenure. And I don't have the PhD, and you knew that when you invited me up here. Herb said, well, let me see what I can do. And they paid me for coming for an interview, and when I got back home in Nebraska, I had a phone call waiting for me and said, when can you come? We made an exception.
So you got both your rank and tenure?
Yeah.
Great.
And I got my full professorship here in 3 years.
So you come up here in 1963?
Yeah.
And you're a full professor by 1966.
I think it was the 1st of January of 67. So it was a little over 3 years.
Yeah. And you must have compiled by this time a pretty impressive list of publications.
Yes. I had developed a system in Nebraska of a cartoon of a crow. I had a tame crow that I took on television program.
Really?
And we developed a character for bulletin covers. They all had this crow symbol on them.
The crow is supposed to be a pretty intelligent bird, isn't it?
They are. I had one in Nebraska that I took on television.
John, when you were recruited to come to Wisconsin, what did they tell you your range of responsibilities would be?
They didn't really... the difference between Nebraska and Wisconsin was in Nebraska they held you to a job specification. And in Wisconsin, Herb Bird said, do what you think needs to be done.
Well, that would have been refreshing, I think.
Yeah.
Did you like that approach?
I liked it because I combined authorship of publications here in Wisconsin with Doug Yang and then a lawyer in Aggie Kahn and Bob Reek and the director and department chairman of the Aggie Kahn department. I bought a publication out entitled Building of Cat Furniture.
Huh.
And that was about the extreme, but I had a publication in the trough of going through printing every time in Nebraska. As soon as one come out off the press, I had another one ready to go.
Now, when you come here, though, you're also doing a lot of extension work.
Yeah.
Are you based in the extension or in the college?
I was based in the college, but the director, the professor that was head of the pool, in other words, Dean Pound, was dean of the College of Agriculture, and he was also director of extension.
Oh, he was. I see.
And he said one time that there's only two people that I hired in the College of Agriculture that don't have PhDs. Roy Heller is one, and Skinner is the other one. And he said, I should make you get your PhD, you know. And I said, well, if I got to, I got to, I guess. And he said, oh, hell, you're too busy now.
You're what?
Too busy now. Because I factory, Saturdays is a full work day and Sundays sometimes.
I see. When you were traveling as the extension agent?
I was represented the poultry interests as the extension agent, but I also represented all the small animals, and they changed my title to the poultry and small animal specialist. Mm-hmm. And so I was publishing in all of the hobby animals, guinea pigs, rabbits, ducks, geese, parrots. I had publications out in tropical fish.
Really? You had a wide range of interest, didn't you?
Yeah. I had all of these things, or mostly all of them, as personal property pets. And I got together with a guy, a geneticist in the animal science department, and he was a mink specialist, or a mink geneticist, and was considered a real light in his field. And we decided that we needed more numbers to keep the department as a separate unit. And I said, talked to the dean of the director of teaching for George Sledge, I said, I think we can put together a program entitled The Biology and Appreciation of Companion Animal, and it'll go over. And he said, well, where can you recruit people for that? Well, I said, you got a school of veterinary medicine just coming on board. And we give it a try, but let me go talk to the dean of Letters and Science and his reaction, because that's where we can get numbers.
And who was the LNS dean then? Was that Cronin?
He was from Nebraska, come the same time as I did. And I can't remember his name.
Not Epstein.
I don't know. His wife played cards with my wife when they were in Nebraska, and then when we moved here, they moved here the same year.
So, but when you're talking to the dean of the vet school, this must have been in the 1980s?
Yeah. And when they were soliciting support for the vet school, Dean Pound put my office address as the return address on the mail sent out for it, because he didn't want to be classed as prejudiced.
Oh, interesting.
And it was kind of touch and go, because Dr. Sundy was currently the head of the poultry department, and he said, I don't think we need a vet school here. And I said, well, I've been told by Dean Pound that he'd like to use my address for all the correspondence on it.
Interesting.
And it was interesting, when the vet school got established, I was pretty good terms with Dick Bristol, the assistant dean of the vet school. And we were known as the pet doctors on Channel 3 television for 5 years.
Really? I'm trying to think of who the LNS dean might have been. Donald Crawford?
That don't sound right.
Was it an acting dean? Crawford Young?
He was a pretty good-sized man. I had so many things that broke in my favor. It's just, I think I'm bragging to tell you about it, but I just couldn't do anything wrong.
Okay, I'll turn it back on now.
So what else broke in your favor?
Well, I managed to get 18 books published in the time that I was here.
18?
Yeah, some of them was overseas, and I wasn't the total author of all of them. But I put out the first public, first color offering of the standard of perfection that poultry judges use. It had been in black and white up to that time. But in 73, for the 100th anniversary of American Poultry Association, they wanted color, and they named me as the goat to do it.
Well, you must have enjoyed that.
Yes, I did. And I was fortunate that I had some spare money that I could work on it, because it was expensive to get 497 color plates.
I'm sure it was.
And I lucked out on that, because I got one of the guys on the committee was Brad Atwood from California, and he knew Diane Jackie, and she was a good artist, and she could turn out a color print every day for better than a year, for a year and a half. And I had one secretary, and that wasn't going to get the job done, so she had a sister that could be brought in and worked, and I could pay her out of grant funds. Just a darn many things. Things I got involved in the dog standard for Samoyed breed.
The what?
The Samoyed breed. Samoyed dog breed.
Uh-huh.
And they wanted a standard like we had for chickens, for judges to use. And so they give a grant of $10,000 to Wisconsin. I think it was $10,000, but I farmed it out to the somehow had it. We put it together so that they could use it for selecting mates for bred dogs across the family. And I didn't do very much with it, but I had got it going, and they put me to farm out the minuscule details of publishing a standard.
Huh.
For a little while, yeah. You know.
John, we're back on, and you were talking about your 18 books, and you were about to start on your first book.
Yeah, the first book that I got really into the swing of things on. I was the editor, and I wrote one chapter, and there was 15 chapters, and it covered the development of the poultry industry in the United States from 1823 to 1973.
Wow, 150 years.
Yeah. And then I wrote the second edition for 20 years in the 90s.
And how did the poultry industry develop?
The first chickens that came to the United States come as mascots on sailing ships. And they were fighting cocks. And when the ships would pull into the dock, the captain would take his rooster under his arm and go hunt up another captain with a rooster. And then after a few seasons, there would be chickens kind of run loose, and they didn't confine them very well, and the captain would turn his rooster loose and give him shore leave.
Is this in colonial America?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you're kind of a historian as well, I take it.
The nearest thing that American Poultry Historical Society had to a historian. My dad knew a lot of the early poultry breeders that were pretty well recognized. And I got to where I was corresponding with them. Harvey Wood from Paterson, New Jersey, was big in light Brahmas. And I was trading chickens with people. I recall C.E. Epley from Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania, sent me a pair of Old English Game Bantams, and I brought them home on the school bus. You come in by Railway Express, and you could sell ship a Railway Express for little or nothing.
Yeah.
And I traded chickens with anybody that could trade with me, and I would make up a string that I could put on the road with Dad's sheep truck.
Yeah.
The fairs, and that was my source of spending money as a kid because I didn't have an allowance.
So, John, when you're here at the university, are you continuing to do work in poultry nutrition?
No. I was more of a public relations man for the industry. And I chose to pick up topics and publicize them. And for instance, one time I was on Right to Farm tours, and the women for Wisconsin Women for Agriculture voted me honorary membership.
Really?
And my colleagues on the campus said, well, now you got something to deal with. You got a damn extension man with courting women.
Did you have much of expectations to teach?
No, I fell into it kind of by backwards. I didn't know what I wanted to do, and it just kind of come and formed around me.
And so what did you teach?
Well, the first class offered in the Biology and Appreciation of Companion Animals.
Yes.
And that was, I organized it and got it going and Dick Shackelford, the mink geneticist, took over when I was on the road during a class period. Uh-huh. And it was only a 2-hour class, so I was usually available on Mondays because they had a staff meeting on Monday. Uh-huh. And I could stay with that. But they finally got me where I was a program leader for agriculture on the Western District of Wisconsin and Southwest District of Wisconsin. And that was just kind of a coordinating function. If some agent was having trouble with his county board, well, I'd sit in on their meetings and offer suggestions.
I could see how you would be good at that. You have a nice feel for people.
And I had night meetings all over the state and was gone so much that Gene said that only the time you come home is to check the mail.
So... was most of your professional work as extension?
Yeah.
And you must have seen a lot of changes in extension during the years you were with
them. It certainly was. And the difference between Wisconsin and Nebraska was as much as night and day. In Wisconsin, they encouraged the cross department. I had time with somebody and I was with ag engineering and with ag econ and I managed to get grants to me that I'd put out to other departments in the campus. A good example of that is Ray Antonewitz, who's a horse specialist. And Ray, he didn't have a budget much in animal science, but I could give him money through the 4-H Foundation. And Jim Converse was head of the Ag Engineering Department, and he was a real help to me because they were scrapping among what people should be doing and whether crossing departmental lines to work and all. And he wrote a piece that was pretty widely accepted, congratulating me for not being afraid to tame with other departments.
Now, what does that mean exactly?
Well, it opens your audience just to double and triple in time. Because if they think you're nothing but chickens, you have a limited population of people to work with. Oh, yeah. But if you're working for, Right to Farm, and they loaned me out to the legislature for Senator Loftus to write the bill in the legislature for the greatest... defense of farmers of any state in the nation. And what we did was to write it so that if a farmer is taken to court for being a nuisance and he's operating on agriculturally zoned land and he's following the instructions of his local agricultural college, he's found guilty, people that initiated the action in court are billed for his expenses for defending himself. And it cut down on a lot of these nuisance cases. Because far in the 80s, particularly, the late 70s and early 80s, there was a lot of cases of the farmer being taken to court because he was creating dust on the woman's laundry hanging on the line. And she was in an agriculturally zoned area and actually didn't have any complaints that were valid because he was doing what he was supposed to be doing.
And in compliance with the zoning.
Yeah. It put a lot of lawyers, especially in California, was it, and New Jersey was trying to find them. They moved residences into farming and agriculturally zoned areas and then complained about the dust and the farming was presenting.
Now, when you are working with Extension, what are the big problems in the field of poultry management that you're encountering?
The first problem is they expanded the flocks for ever bigger numbers was pollution.
Yeah.
And we used to say the pollution to dilution, or the pollution to the solution to pollution is dilution.
Oh.
And as long as farms were small, and it was your location was dilution. But when they got too big for that, they had to plan the disposal of the waste just as much as they plan the source of feed. And we were slow to really get that across. I started talking it in the 60s.
Really?
And it wasn't until about the 90s that it really got a hold of the people that were causing the trouble.
Were there big poultry outfits in Wisconsin, or are they mostly in the southern United States?
It changes from time to time. There was a big one over here at Lake Mills,
oh.
Creekwood Farms. And there's one that's down near Burlington. And incidentally, Century Stores owns the one down by Burlington. And they tried to hire me when they were thinking of putting it up and all, and I said, I'm flattered that you got confidence in me to do that, but I'll advise you and it won't cost you anything.
Well, there's a deal for them. This was Century, you said?
Yeah. It's funny, when you get to where you're advising people, you get all kinds of trouble stirred up. For instance, when Dutchman Equipment Company, I think it was, were putting up a laying house, cage layers, and they asked me to advise the man that was buying it. And I said, well, now you know that I'm not paid by him, and so I'm going to be as honest as I can with you, and we'll get it going to where it works for you. And I got a phone call about the next day from one of their salesmen, and they say, we would be glad to cut you in on a percentage of the complex if you advise them in our favor. And I said, you can't do that. I wouldn't accept it. He said, well, don't be so quick to judge. He said, your son might like to have a new convertible, wouldn't he?
Wow. So you were affirmed in your much earlier decision to get out of the business of business and sales.
You can't ignore that it's going to happen, but you don't want to be a part of it. I had a rabbit processing plant going up in the northeast part of the state, pretty close to Appleton. And they got it going for a couple of years, and it was going pretty good. And I told them that you can't sell rabbit meat by being cost cutting and trying to get below the competition. You got to sell it for its uniqueness. And they finally admitted that I was right, and they closed it up. Huh. They took a chicken processing plant and converted it to processing rabbits. Mm-hmm. And the devils that raised the rabbits, they wouldn't give a part of it unless they had control of the price. And you got to have nerves of steel if you're going to take the rabbit and compare him to chicken, because the rabbit processes out to about 50% meat of the live weight. And you can take turkeys and get it into the 72%.
But rabbits are just 50%?
Yeah. And the reason is that rabbits eat a roughage diet, and not a concentrated diet.
Yeah. I've never had rabbit. Do you like rabbit meat?
Yes. It's a good rabbit is good meat.
A few restaurants in town do serve rabbit, like the Tornado Club off the square. So maybe I should try it the next time I'm there.
Yeah, get one portion and divide it between several people as a safety factor.
There's a good idea. So you start working at Extension in 1963 here. And how long do you work? When do you retire?
I retired in 85. So I was 22 years.
Yeah. And what changes did you see in the Extension during your time there?
Well, if you look at the time that I entered it and was in it, and when I left, my successor didn't have near the expense account that I did.
And is that because they were cutting back on the amount of field work?
No, the thing that happened was that they cut back on university budgets and tried to make an industry pay for the extension work. great proud push to get make extension self-supporting.
I did not realize that. And was that approach successful?
It created a different audience. For confirmed businessmen and women will see the advantage of a good program, and they won't look at the cost of it till they get the proof that it works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you had pretty good ties yourself with industry leaders, did you not?
Yes. I had invitations for a free lunch a lot of time.
What were the, can you list for me some of the major companies you worked with?
Well, I was with Godfrey Stores on their poultry farm operation at Eagle. And they wanted me to recommend the equipment and just to kind of push them, and when they're leaning, and need a little more push to get on down.
Yeah. And during your career, you're also active in the national meetings.
Yeah. And one of the things I did early on there was introduce a business card to the extension. They didn't thought it was too commercial to have to pull out a card and hand the guy.
Really?
Huh. And by the time that I had been doing it for about five years. Darn near all the extension men that I was in contact with were pulling out their business cards.
And John, did you, for the balance of your career, were you primarily, mostly at extension?
Yeah. I was 100% of extension in Wisconsin and Nebraska.
I see. And what's the status of extension today? Is there a John Skinner for poultry and small animals in extension today?
They've got one man that's teaching about 300 students every year, and he's writing a column for a magazine, an agricultural magazine at Dallas, Wisconsin, and he answers a lot of letters and phone call, but he doesn't do much traveling and for visits. And I was a sort of a roaming reporter that I'd drop into a hatchery and put on an apron and box chicks for if they were hatching that day.
Yeah.
And they'd tell me their problems, and I'd listen to them and then try to program accordingly.
It seems to me that extension doesn't do as much hands-on work as it used to do, and that the state suffers for that.
I think you're right. You've got to be hands-on to really understand how to react to things.
Yes, you do. And I think that that's one of the problems the university's having with the state legislature, is that the university's not as present out in the state as it used to be. Would you agree or disagree?
Yeah. I think that publicity makes or breaks a thing. And you can't get a publicity unless you get acceptance to ideas.
Right. And you get acceptance to ideas by being out there and talking to people.
Yeah.
Did you give a lot of speeches in the state? Like, did you talk to Rotaries and Kiwanis clubs?
Oh, yes. And I had a lot of 4-H meetings, countywide, Saturday morning, and for the leaders and the kids too, but I wanted to get the leaders into it.
Yeah. And after you retired in 1985, did you continue to be professionally active?
Yeah, I didn't have to try. It followed me.
Oh, I see.
But they left my name on the office door for 12 years.
At Extension?
In the poultry department.
In the poultry department. So you had an office in the animal science building?
Yeah, 259. I was right across the hall from the secretarial pool.
Oh, I see. Now, John, were you working with graduate students as well in poultry science?
I was unofficially working with them. I wasn't signed up as a teacher. And when I took the biology and appreciation of companion animals to the committee that approves coursework, I had to be sure that I covered my extension time, because I was 50% federal appointment and 50% University of Wisconsin.
And the federal portion was for extension, I assume?
Yeah. The way extension is funded is that it comes from the federal government, and then a percentage of salary of people in various departments. And I wanted, that's another thing I insisted on here was 50% of the extension federally supported. No teaching, no research.
Uh-huh.
Because then I qualified for both retirement system.
John, was it ever an issue for your colleagues that you did not have a PhD?
They teased me about it. But my associate had a 90, no, he was 10% research and 10% for federal and some teaching and research. But I didn't want it to divide it up, because if you didn't get 50% of it in one division, you didn't qualify for top retirement.
John, can I ask you a little bit about your experience with the university itself?
Yeah.
You've been here since 1963. What are the big changes you've noticed in the university itself?
Well, the university itself, from my standpoint, is there's more emphasis on being self-supporting. Put on a conference and you charge an admission fee or a registration fee. I used to hold a seminar about once a month of some kind or another in the animal science building on Saturdays. And I could get rabbit raisers and hobby farmers and game bird raisers, and they'd come in and they'd rub elbows with each other and solve a lot of their problems just by their mingling.
Uh-huh. That doesn't happen so much anymore.
No, it doesn't. They want to see the bottom line, and it is hard to generate funds now as compared to what it was when there was a lot of us that would come out of service in World War II that were on government payrolls one way and another.
Uh-huh.
And we could generate darn near anything on Saturday.
Did you have much experience with any of the chancellors of the university? Did you have much to do with Irv Shane or Sewell? Or?
No, not a heck of a lot. Extension is typically agricultural directed. And there's more crossing. A good example, in Nebraska, I was told that my job was to be following work schedules and so forth with the department and my specialty of poultry. And they didn't encourage you to cross departmental lines and co-author. And when I got here, that was the first thing I noticed, was they welcomed me, and I'd try anything.
Yes. And you would reach out to other departments.
Yeah.
To take it.
I had good relationship with Ag Econ Department, good relationship with Ag Engineering.
And those were all housed in the College of Ag and Life Sciences,
yeah.
Right?
It's kind of hard to understand how they can have so many chains of command and follow through to the campus, the federal portion of the university comes from Washington.
What are your observations about the closing of the Department of Poultry Science by Dean Roger Weiss?
I felt it in my heart.
I'm sure. How and why did that happen?
We had too many professors for the number of students we had. You take a department in letters and science, they can set up a class and draw 20 or 30 students. And you set up a class in a specialty of poultry, and you might get three.
And was there a decline in the number of students interested in poultry?
Well, poultry was, and they consolidated the units. It used to be that you had 500 hens, you had a great big flock of chickens. Now you measure them in millions.
Right.
And they don't take a lot of educated people to, if you got a good system of moving the orders from the headquarters down.
Did you think that Dean Weiss made the right decision, even though it was painful?
I can't say that without getting emotional. We had, from Wisconsin, you could go to darn near any state in the Union and find poultry-educated people from tracing back to Wisconsin. One time, Milt Sunday put out the number of departmental heads that had Wisconsin roots.
Really?
And I, for instance, have a student that I was influencing and not officially. And he's in Clemson, South Carolina. And he's done almost identical things to what I did here. Oh. And he's just about ready to retire. Same is true of a guy that was my last associate in Pennsylvania. He moved from, he was in Virginia, and he moved up to Pennsylvania because he could get into a spot that was more similar to mine.
Can you explain to me the difference between commercially raised and processed chicken and organic chicken?
No, because you can't find a chicken that's inorganic.
But what about what is said that the organic, so-called organic chicken, are better for you or taste better?
Well, there's such a wide range of possibilities there that they taste better because they're different. They're grown slower, and they're more flavorful and not so much water than the meat.
Oh, I see.
It's just the difference between veal and beef.
Oh, that's interesting. Do you like to eat chicken?
Yes. I shouldn't say it, but I prefer chicken to turkey. And turkey is entering into a lot of restaurant menus.
Yes.
And chicken is too, for that matter, but you can get bigger cuts of meat from a turkey than you can from a chicken.
Yes, I just, for the first time in my life, barbecued a whole, one of those midget turkeys the other day. It was delicious. This now concludes the first session with Professor John Skinner on August 15th, 2013, to be continued tomorrow.